Hey folks, in this episode of This Week in Photo, it's all about Lumix.
This is TWIP.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of This Week in Photo. I'm your host, Frederick Van Johnson. Today, we're going to be talking about a camera brand that's near and dear to my heart, personally, and both of my guests, and that's Lumix. It's a camera. It's the brand that I shoot. My daily driver is the Lumix G9, and I love that camera. I think the first week I had it, it was on the pillow next to me, you know, much to the chagrin of the other person. But I love that camera. It's amazing. But the other two guys on the show, Shiv Verma and Don Komoreczka, are also in the Lumix family. And we're going to talk about, it's not going to be a Lumix love fest, but what I want to talk about is just some of the new things that are coming out, full frame, et cetera, new lenses, adapters, et cetera. But also I want to expand it out to the greater world of the mirrorless, full frame specifically, and the changes that we've seen over the last year. So let's dive right in. Let's start with the introduction. Shiv Verma, you're on the show. You've been on the show. It's been a while. You know, I was looking...
Not that long.
Long. But
no, it's good to be back.
It is good to have you back. What have you been working on, man? What's going on with Shiv Verma?
Just finished with Photo Plus Expo, and... getting ready for another long week over at the Crane Festival in Bosque, which is about 10 days. So, that's going to be the last big one for the year. And then got a couple of trips lined up for next year, apart from the shows in Florida. I'm going to do Vietnam that you never did, so.
Oh, good. That's cool. Yeah, so, I love having you on the show. You know why? Because, like I always say, you are the adult voice of the show, but you have the coolest accent. You should read audiobooks, I'm telling you. It's awesome.
I second that.
Thank you. But to be honest with you, Frederick, you should come along for Vietnam.
Oh, all right. Well, let's talk after the show because, you know, Vietnam is near and dear to my heart. It's been a while. I need to get back to that.
I was trying to convince Tom Curley to do the same, but he said he's already done it, and so he doesn't want to do it again. But I think it's worth doing it.
You've seen everything there is to see on an entire country. Come on.
No way. Never.
Well, also on the show, Don Komoreczka is here. What's going on, Don? Our neighbor up to the north.
Yeah, well, I mean, winter is coming, and so I'm preparing for my snowflake photography stuff, and so that's big. But funny enough, a year ago, I had somebody tip me off that, and this is my weird mad scientist photography, that South African succulents, they will fluoresce, the flowers of those plants will fluoresce beautifully in ultraviolet light and glow into magical colors. So I bought some. And now finally they are blossoming a year later. And so that is an investment in time and effort. And I posted a photo of one of them recently, and I've got another one that's about to bloom too. And so that's just, I go down all these strange rabbit holes. Today I was also trying to hack my red hydrogen camera to put my 3D images on it because they haven't released any software for that. And I was successful in doing so in a sense. So I like to tinker. I like to toil away in obscurity and eventually come up with something interesting.
You know what? I think you should embrace your persona. And when you come on This Week in Photo, you should always just wear like a lab coat and maybe have some beakers and some water, some colored water boiling in the background or something.
No, and oh, now it's going to happen. Now he can have time. a glowing Protea sitting in front of him.
Exactly.
Lighting up his face.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's good. Well, welcome. Don, before we dive in, you're running a podcast now. When you and I talked briefly a couple days ago, it's going pretty well. Give us a 10-second snippet of what's going on with your show.
Oh, I'd love to. The elevator pitch is Photo Geek Weekly at photogeekweekly.com. We try to find the geekiest, most technical news stories in the photographic industry on a weekly basis, and me and a guest host discuss them, pull them apart, and find everything under the hood that might not be easily discussable if you're just scratching the surface. So the last episode that we put out yesterday was with Andy Anatko, and he is a wonderful, whimsically wise individual in the technology industry, and we had a great discussion. I always have great hosts. on there with me to just totally geek out about photography.
Love it. Love it. Well, cool. Well, it's good to have you away from your show and back onto This Week in Photo for a little bit. So
yeah, clean rooms and bunny suits.
Clean rooms and bunny suits. Yes. That's what you should have named your show. Clean rooms and bunny suits and the occasional lens and camera.
Love it. Exactly.
Cool. All right, guys. Well, speaking of lenses and cameras, let's dive into the topic du jour of this episode of This Week in Photo, and that is Lumix and the greater sort of ecosystem that's growing around mirrorless and the fervor around mirrorless. Let's start with, and Shiv, I'll throw it to you first. I know you were speaking, or you were in one of the booths. You were at the Hunts photo booth, right?
Right.
Photo Plus Expo. Mm-hmm. So you're familiar with the lineup. Both of you guys are, all of us are familiar with the new lineup. But why don't you take us through some of the cool things from your perspective for your genre of photography that Panasonic and Lumix are doing with their new offerings, i.e. full frame?
So, I mean, I think there's a transition from where Panasonic is right now to where they're going. And, you know, first of all, I think we need to dispel any rumors that have been floating around. And one of them being, oh, maybe now mirrorless cameras and the Micro Four Thirds world is dead. Clearly, I think, you know, people need to understand that folks like Canon and Nikon have had fundamentally two formats, I mean, the APS-C and then the full frame. The only distinction or sort of advantage they probably had between them is the fact that their lenses were compatible with both formats. The same lens can be used on either camera. Whereas with the Micro Four Thirds, the size of the opening doesn't allow for the same lens to basically work on both systems. So, you know, you come out with a new larger opening. And what's nice with Panasonic and what they've done is that rather than try and invent another brand new lens mount system, to have adopted what Leica has already created. And the relationship with Leica, which has been, you know, there from the very beginning, has sort of structured a format that has lenses already out there. I mean, people say, oh, Panasonic's going to be coming out with three lenses. Yes, they're going to be three Lumix lenses, but that's not to preclude all the Leica L series lenses that are already out there.
Sure.
And then, unlike what happened originally when Micro Four Thirds came out and people started making adapters, there are a ton of adapters already available for the L mount system that adapt a plethora of lenses. And then you've got, you know, another sort of, clearly the company may be going under, as they say, but the Meir Golitz company, which makes a number of lenses, very interesting lenses, they have a series of L mounts. And then you've got a company called Handle Vision. They've got a series of L mounts. Mm-hmm. So there is no dearth of L mount lenses. So, yeah.
I want to dive into that because there was a discussion that you guys mentioned that Tony Northrup on the Tony and Chelsea Northrup had a video.
Well, actually, Chelsea was not doing so well that day, so Tony did it on his own
by himself. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I haven't watched it yet, but you guys are
the sanity check was missing.
It was sort of it was painting a picture that Micro Four Thirds is dying because Panasonic doesn't have the horsepower to push two distinct camera systems. Don Komarechka, is from your perspective, I mean, I know you're not inside Panasonic and you're not looking in their checkbook, but what do you think? I mean, can both of these systems, the Micro Four Thirds and full frame architectures, be supported by Panasonic successfully?
Well, could other manufacturers have two different sensor sizes and be successful? Yeah, just look at every other camera manufacturer and they are being successful within that. So I don't think that's a divide. In fact, the divide between a very small sensor, Micro Four Thirds, and a full frame camera and having distinct systems is actually an advantage, because you don't have as much of an overlap. If you want to get a Micro Four Thirds camera, I use mine a lot for travel photography because it's lightweight and all of the lenses are noticeably smaller. But for macro photography as well, which is right in my wheelhouse, the smaller sensor on a one-to-one macro lens gives me about twice the magnification compared to a sensor twice the size. And so there's a lot of advantages of that smaller system that you cannot replace when you go to a larger platform. The larger platform has its own advantages. And I've been a full-frame camera shooter for many years, and I know those well. But from a consumer standpoint, Panasonic will have the muscle to put forward so long as there's demand on each platforms. And regardless of Panasonic's involvement, if you look at the industry as a whole, there has always been significant demand for Micro Four Thirds and significant demand for full-frame mirrorless cameras. One does not cannibalize the other. So long as the company is successful, the sales are there, which all of the history of the industry in the last decade or so has shown us. Yeah. Then there's no issue. It's not a question.
But in the minds of consumers that aren't as sort of plugged into the ecosystems or the industry as we three are, your mind or our minds tend to sort of categorize things like what's from least or not as good to best. Right. So on the not as good side, you might say, well, you know, they introduced this new thing. It's full frame. Clearly, it's better. It's more pixels. It's bigger and presumably better low light performance and all that. So shouldn't I be getting the best of the best? Or on the Micro Four Thirds side, should I get something down there? And it's a smaller sensor, albeit, you know, more flexible. Shivarma, how do you answer that? If someone walks up to you and they say, you know, which camera should I buy? I heard Lumix is great. Which one should I get? How do you answer?
The question is very simple. You ask, what is it that you want to shoot? Mm-hmm. And Don said it right. I mean, there is a place for both cameras. In fact, there is a place for multiple cameras. You've got Micro Four Thirds, you've got APS-C, you've got full frame, you've got medium format. They all have a place in the industry. It's all based upon what it is that you want to do with your camera. Clearly, if there is a full frame camera, and if I was to look at the reason why I went to Micro Four Thirds was to go smaller, become more nimble, become more flexible in the way I did things in nature and wildlife. So for nature and wildlife, I'm not necessarily going to use a full-frame camera with large lenses. That's what I went away from. Yeah. So there is a place for Micro Four Thirds and all the phenomenal lenses that Panasonic has for me to do what I want to do. Now, I have another, sort of thing which I photograph, which is landscapes. Mm-hmm. Landscapes don't require me to be nimble. I mean, I can go places, carry my car, unless I'm trekking a lot, which I don't. I'm too old to do that kind of stuff. So for that work, I will take a full-frame camera. So there is a place for each of those cameras. Now, as far as my commercial work is concerned, I've always been struggling with, how much can I do with a Micro Four Thirds sensor because of its size. That issue now is resolved. I mean, there's going to be a Panasonic full-frame camera that I can use to do that work. Mm-hmm. So, why do photographers use medium format? Well, because it has resolution and it's for product photography and it's for portraiture, etc. Well, there's a camera too. So I think as long as Panasonic stays ahead of the curve, stays with the kind of product that the market demands, there's no reason for them not to be successful in full frame and to keep the Micro Four Thirds form factor alive.
Yeah, yeah, and hopefully to keep innovating on that. So,
absolutely, absolutely.
Don Komarecki, I'm going to throw it to you. So the lineup, the new things that are coming out from Panasonic that you can talk about, right? So there's the new series of full frame cameras and lenses. Which in the lineup has you most excited? And or you can run through the whole thing if you want.
Well, if I were to look through my my Lightroom catalog and sort it out by metadata, what lenses I would use the most often, the 24 to 105 focal range is by far the number one lens that I would use for everyday purposes. And so that is definitely a lens that I'm going to be getting day one whenever I can get my hands on it, because it is a very flexible focal range. But beyond that, I mean, I'm getting into more video work for certain projects, and you know, we don't know the full specs. You know, as people are working on firmware behind the scenes to make these products the best as they could possibly be. But I look at what's coming, not just from Panasonic, but also they've partnered, of course, with Sigma. So all of the Sigma lenses designed for full frame mirrorless cameras are going to be available at some point in the very near future for the L mount. And of course, Leica has their lenses. They might be a bit out of my price range, but they would work just fine too. The beauty, I think, though, is that this L-mount alliance, or whatever word that they want to use to call it, between the three companies, means that they can all produce cameras on this platform as well. And they're all going to be marketing on this platform because they are putting all of their eggs into that basket. I mean, everybody has their different platforms. Of course, Leica has their M-series rangefinders, and Panasonic has Micro Four Thirds, et cetera. But everybody's compiling everything into this one thing for a big push. If you wanted to buy a Sigma Foveon full-frame sensor, that's going to be an L-mount camera, and you're going to get glass for that. And if you wanted to jump over and say, let's, you know, dip my toes in the water on a Panasonic S-series camera, I can do that. All of my glass is compatible. Yeah. And so much in the same way that an Olympus lens can be used on a Panasonic Micro Four Thirds camera, there's going to be a certain synergy, I think, with the, within this environment that we won't see with any other full-frame mirrorless camera on the market. Because Nikon and Canon, they don't talk to each other, and they certainly are not going to be buddying up to Sony any point soon. So I think that this brings a lot of momentum to the race. And that's needed because the race has been going for a while. You know, Sony has been kind of the only party moving forward.
And you bring up a good point, and that's a good phrase to put on this race, right? So it's a race between all of these camera manufacturers, and it seems like it's been heating up this year. I mean, it's at the melting point in some ways this year with all Nikon and Sony and, you know, all these different companies, Fuji, like everyone is in this. So The question becomes, for, you know, looking at it through the Lumix lens, is can Panasonic compete in this landscape with the forward momentum that Sony has, with the irrational exuberance that I call it of the Fuji customer base, with the, you know, the people that love their Olympus cameras, with the Nikon, you know, that came in with the new Z series cameras that sort of stave the bleeding of people leaving Nikon and moving to Sony, and whatever Canon's doing, you know, all this, there's a lot of chum in the water right now. So Shiv, can Panasonic like navigate that chum and still survive?
Yeah, I mean, go back before mirrorless. 35mm. Mm-hmm. How many manufacturers were there in that world? Right? I mean, you had Sony, you had Olympus, you had Leica, you had Konica, Minolta, you name it, they were all there. They all survived. Yeah. It's when mirrorless became very much the forefront of the camera industry, did some of those companies start, you know, their merry death, as I call it. But I mean, even a company like Minolta had so much beautiful technology in their lens world that when Sony bought them out, I think Sony's success in their lenses and their G Master series lenses is based upon the fact that they were able to acquire the technology from Minolta. So, you know, there was a place for them all. I think the issue that we're wrestling with today is, will everybody be able to keep up with what Sony has done or come close enough to what they've been able to produce or actually leapfrog them? Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, we've seen that Nikon and Canon with their announcements have not done anything to leapfrog Sony. Sony hasn't had and the need for even an iota of a response to these two announcements. They're sitting pretty. I mean, their cameras, they know, are far superior to what has been produced, and they will sit happily till they need to come up with something else, hence no announcements. Panasonic, on the other hand, has done something really phenomenal with the S series. I mean, there's a lot more in that camera, even with the minimal announcement that, you know, they've come up with. I mean, the kind of responsiveness they have to image stabilization, dual IS. Nobody has dual IS like Panasonic does. Right. And if they implement that on the full frame, which they have said they will, that's going to blow away the competition as far as image stabilization is concerned. You've got, you know, 4K 60p. Who's got that? And the fact that it's now a larger, you know, format, you've got more body space, hence you've got more heat dissipation capability. So they're not going to have the same issues that Sony had when they came up with, you know, 4K on their cameras. So it's a series of, I call these leapfrogs. I mean, these are leapfrogs to what Sony has. And I think that's what's going to make the product so successful.
But if there's leapfrogging, when I hear you say that, I think, you know, I think it's like a restaurant, right? I could see, like, in the restaurateur industry, you know, there's competition. Like, hey, I'm going to put out a new dish and I'm going to get more customers at my restaurant next weekend than you had at your restaurant. With hardware, cameras, for example, it's different, right? Because you buy in. It's a huge investment to buy into a body and the lenses and the ecosystem. And it becomes like flypaper or Stockholm syndrome. Once you're in it, you're in it. So when, well, for the most part, you can break free and go switch, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's not as easy as just making the decision to go to the restaurant next door versus this one. But when you say leapfrog, I wonder, you know, if let's say Lumix and Panasonic introduces a superior, let's say the new cameras that are coming out are superior to the A7 series that are out there now. Mm-hmm. Are they superior enough? And is Panasonic's marketing strong enough to create enough gravity to pull people away from other brands into the Lumix brand, or is Panasonic sort of relegated to pulling in, I'm using astrophysics metaphors, but, you know, relegated to pulling in loose asteroids that haven't found an orbit yet? You know, Don, you're the science geek here. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that play in Panasonic's favor, and it all goes back to this relationship with their partners too, because Sigma also announced that they're going to do a mount conversion service. Mm-hmm. So if you have an existing Sigma lens for a different mount, and I'm sure that there will be limitations on what mounts will be available for the service, you can convert that to the L mount. And I was just shocked because I thought that wouldn't be even feasible for a company to offer, but they're putting a lot of muscle in that. So if you have existing lenses, you can get them natively compatible to this new system. Now, Panasonic has also stated very vaguely that by the Tokyo Olympics, that they will have an 8K capable camera. And so that just kind of put a marker in the future to said, okay, well, we're creating this now, but we're not stopping here. We're not dipping our toe in the water and see what's going to come of that. Mm-hmm. We have plans. There is a roadmap, and we're not necessarily privy to that roadmap. But by planting that one little seed, you know that if you invest into the system now, then it will carry you forward, quite some distance. But the interesting thing is, if you are an existing Canon or Nikon shooter, you're going to have to either adapt your lenses or switch into a totally new system. And when Canon first came out with their the EOS R, they put out a 40-page white paper I read, and it was interesting because I didn't have to read between the lines on that. They listed in point form all of the points of failure of the EF system that cannot be overcome by re-engineering that system, but by having to reimagine it. And all of the things that once you can reimagine it, all of these other possibilities come in as well. And so that just puts the writing on the wall for any Canon shooter that if you're going to be jumping into the EOS R, then you're going to have to jump into a totally new system. But where is brand loyalty then at that point? Because if Canon is kind of abandoning you to some degree, then will you stick with them? I mean, maybe. But if there are better offerings that are knocking on your door and saying, hey, you know what? And Sigma, of course, is, again, I think it's the linchpin in all of this in terms of compatibility and lenses. If you're a Sony shooter, if you're a Canon shooter, Nikon, Sigma's made lenses and understands the autofocus and the communication systems of all of these lenses, and they've said that they're going to make as many adapters as they can to bring that all the way in. So from that perspective, you're not abandoning anything when you jump into this new ecosystem. Everything, so long as you were a full frame shooter, is going to come along with you.
Yeah. Well, let's zoom out a little bit, right? So, you know, part of this, and like I said before, you all three of us are sort of marinating in this world, but most consumers, I would argue, are not. You know, they're just if they're looking, or they've been sitting on the sidelines and looking to get a nice semi-pro professional system. If it were me, I would be overwhelmed with analysis paralysis right now with all the choices that are out there. If you got old, you're like, oh, I love this photography thing, I want to get into it, and all I have is this old, you know, film camera stuff in the closet, and I want to get into the new state-of-the-art mirrorless stuff that everyone's raving about, and you start studying up, how do you make a choice? Like, you know, you've got the Lumix, you've got all these different brands that are all saying that they're better than the other one. How do you make a choice on which one to go with?
Well, I think, you know, Don said something very interesting, which is really a very valid point, and that is that Canon basically have come around to a fact, and that's reality. If you don't go to the Canon R system, the EOS R, the EOS previous as known, with all of the glass, et cetera, is fundamentally flawed and thereby will die.
Yep.
How long will it take for it to die? I don't know. But there are two kinds of death taking place. One is the fact that it's not mirrorless. And the other is that it's basically got some fundamental flaws. So if you're going to switch from where you are today as a loyal Canon person, mm-hmm, to something that's going to give you the same image quality, the same sensor size, et cetera, you have basically two choices. Move to the R system and hope for the best, because you are really hoping for the best. I mean, there's 10 years of technology that Panasonic has under their belt for mirrorless, and Canon has a few years. I don't know how many. They may have had 10 years too, but I don't know. They haven't shown it. This is the first time they've come out with something that's viable. They came out with, you know, a previous product that was died basically the day it was announced. So if you're a shooter looking to switch, where are you going? You're either going to Sony or Panasonic. Those are the two choices. Now, splitting the pie in two pieces, where the majority today may look like Sony, but tomorrow, when the S series comes out with all of its feature functionality, and we don't even know all the specs right now. Yeah. I mean, the specs are better than what we've seen.
Sure.
So I think people are going to wait till the product is actually fully announced before they start jumping. You don't want to jump to such a large investment and not be sure of what you're doing. So I think that there's going to be a little bit of a wait. And it may show, even though Sony announced, you know, definitely a very profitable quarter, 5% increase is big for them.
Yes.
Who knows what the next quarter is going to be like? If it's stagnant, then you know what people are doing. You know what they're thinking.
Sure.
Nikon, on the other hand, who knows with them? I mean, they've come out with a product that at least has been accepted by their base, but it has other big issues. So who knows?
Yeah.
I'm not worried about Nikon space so much.
The whole space is eating up or heating up. Don Komarenska, what do you say? Like, the advice that you give to people, like I was saying, they've got their old DSLR or their old SLR in the closet, and they want to move from film to digital, and they're overwhelmed by the choice. What would be your advice? You're having coffee with this person, and they ask you the question, which one should I, where should I go, Don? There's so much stuff out there. What do you tell them?
Well, if you're coming from the film era, for one, I mean, you're playing the long game for sure. So, but if we continue along that long game analogy, you look at what Sony's doing with their E-mount. And I saw a really fun article recently that compared the actual diameters of all of these mounts. And the E-mount was surprisingly tiny. And I think Sony really had to do some engineering miracles to get a full-frame camera sensor inside of that, because the corners of the sensor are actually pretty much hitting the edge of the lens mount. Wow. And that might limit some of your lens mount design. Comparatively, and this was unusual, Shiv mentioned the Canon EOS M. You didn't mention it by name, but it's kind of on life support right now. It actually has a mount diameter that is 1 millimeter larger than the Sony E-mount, and Canon is only ever producing APS-C sensors within that. So if you have a larger mount, then you have more flexibility in how you design your optics without compromising them based on, you know, the flange distance, which has been a big issue on the flapping mirror cameras for the longest time. And when that goes away, you can make a lens at the same engineering cost much better, or at a lesser cost equally to what we're currently used to. And so I think that's a huge advantage moving forward, is that the optics for the same dollar value are going to get better. Or if you're looking at what we have today, it just gets cheaper in terms of what we can create. So if you look forward, a larger lens mount, I think, is better. And that's where I'm looking at Canon and Panasonic. I think Canon has the biggest. But when you get so big at a certain point and that rear element has to be much larger, it also changes the way you design optics. And it's not a bigger is better scenario. There is a sweet spot. And I think that's why Panasonic teamed up with Leica when they saw their L mount. Instead of reinventing the wheel, they said, this is it. I mean, this is as close as we're going to get to the perfect mount. So we're jumping on board.
All right. So I'm gonna switch gears yet again and bring us back out of the gears and widgets cloud into more of the artistic side of things. So, but I'm gonna weave it in there cleverly. So we've got, like I was saying, we've got sort of a universe or a solar system of gear and choices to choose from. And one of the interviews I did just yesterday with Joe Edelman from, you know, he's an Olympus shooter. And part of the discussion was how gear can sort of obfuscate the idea of creating art. In fact, he went so far as to say that he coined the term geartographer. Right, where, and that's a person that is more obsessed with acquiring the latest and best gear and talking about it than actually making photographs with that amazing gear that they have. So, under that umbrella, what's the advice that you guys give to, and you know, we'll throw it to you, Shiv, first. What's the advice that you give to a person that is saying, "Hey, you know, I'm an artist. I want to buy this new system, but I'm sort of getting confused and distracted by all this cool stuff that's out there." How do you get them to focus on just, you know, being an artist and looking at the hardware as a tool versus as an object of desire, like, you know, the ring in Lord of the Rings?
I'm going to say something which probably won't go down well with a lot of people. I mean, if you have, you know, just gear acquisition, gas, just, that's it, right?
Gas.
Then you're not an artist. Yes, then you're not an artist, because all you're interested in doing is buying gear and hoping that the gear is going to do your art for you. Mm-hmm. Art is you. Art is not the camera. Art is not the lenses. I mean, they help. The best artist, you know, does he need to use a brush? No, he can use his fingers and create art. So you don't even have to have an external tool if you are truly an artist. And I feel exactly the same way as far as cameras are concerned. These are tools. They assist you in doing what it is that you want to do. If you believe you're an artist, then don't worry about what gear you buy.
Yeah.
It'll do it for you. So
I agree. But, you know, at the same time, and Don, I'll let you answer this as well. At the same time, you know, I'm not saying that I'm on some cloud and don't have any of that gear acquisition syndrome. I get as, like, you know, you start having the reality distortion field and the, well, let me see how much money I can, you know, I can squeeze that out of my bank account when you see these new camera bodies and new lenses and all that stuff show up. Don, how do you manage that? And I give this question to both of you guys, because you're both accomplished artists, right? And you're not gear-tographers. You're not looking for, you know, you don't do it in reverse where you're like, hey, I'm gonna buy this piece of gear, then figure out how I can make stuff with it. It's, I have a problem I need to solve. It's really, both of you guys, I have a problem I need to solve, snowflakes or whatever, and I need a piece of gear that can do that for me. Let me go get that so I can execute what's in my mind's eye. Don Comaresco, what do you say to the whole gear versus art argument?
That is such a gray line. And I'm going to give a couple of analogies here. My wife and I were recently in Vienna, and we went into one of their art museums, and we saw Klimt's The Kiss. And Gustav Klimt, if you're not familiar with his work, look up The Kiss, a wonderful painting using metal, golds and silvers and platinums and what have you. And it's a signature piece of his. But when you see it, it's massive. It would not have had the similar impact on me if it was the size of the Mona Lisa, which I think is overhyped. But from the art world, I mean, because it was so big and you could nose up to it and see so much detail, there was value in that. And the fact that he decided to paint it big was valuable. But, you know, if you make art on any scale, any size, any resolution, so long as it's good art, it will survive. You look at all of the images made on 35 millimeter film that are iconic. You know, if I say Tank Man to you, you can picture it. If I say Napalm Girl, you can picture it. I mean, these are images that were made in the era of film that are iconic and award-winning, and they're made on what we consider antiques today. Yeah. But I still have gear acquisition syndrome. Yeah. Because, you know, like even sitting on my desk here, I've got a Metabone speed booster adapter that I'll be using this winter to put my Canon MPE 65 millimeter super macro lens onto a GX9 or a G9 Micro Four Thirds camera, and I'm going to shoot snowflakes with that because that's going to be fun. But I'm combining gear together. I've made very successful images on what would be considered antiquated lenses. You know, as you know, Shiv mentioned the Meyer optic lenses. I've got their TrioPlan 100, and the standard triplet design is necessarily flawed, but that can create some interesting bokeh in the background, and you can use that to artistic effect. It doesn't need to be pixel perfect. You've got to understand what tools you have and how to make the most of them. And if you think that your tools are limited, you are most likely wrong. There are some exceptions if you're really pushing the limits of physics and science and technology, but if you're pushing the limits of artistry, you can do that with what you have right now.
Yeah, very well said. Very well said. You know, the other piece of this is, you know, we could talk ad nauseum about, so, you know, art versus hardware, gear acquisition syndrome, gear-tography. But I want to switch gears yet again and talk about gear. Right? So, I mean, this is what the show is about.
Come back to reality.
The show is about gear, so I want to talk about. But from both of your standpoints, you guys approach photography from two different vectors, right? So from the standpoint of what's missing in the gear that you currently own, like what are the features? If you're going to write a love letter or an open letter to the powers that be, Shiv, I'll start with you. Don, you can start formulating your answer. Shiv, the powers that be at Panasonic, and you say, you know, I love everything about this system, but I need this thing right here in order to push my work to the next level. What's missing? What do you need in the camera system that's not present today?
You know, it's a very difficult question because
I want to play some Jeopardy
technology,
music.
Technology has reached a point where there's not a whole lot more that one needs or one requires, mm-hmm. you know, when it comes to photography. You're always looking for, you know, will I have edge-to-edge sharpness? Will I have this? Will I have that? Or can I get this? But, you know, there are ways around it. So if it's going to be a piece of technology that is going to take the price point above and beyond what you will then be able to afford, why ask for it? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's kind of, you know, what Google tried to do with Google Glass. Wear it and take it, you know. I mean, just do it. Maybe technology could get to that point. But then what am I doing? If my eyes see something and I can say, well, take a picture and make it look like exactly what I want it to be, then what have I achieved?
Sure.
So I don't want to get to a point where the artist in me, as I say, has no value left. Because my brain can do the photography.
I think that might be inevitable, though. I mean, we're heading in that direction with all this.
Well, yes, we are.
You know, computational photography augmented this. It's coming fast, and we're only in 2018. Imagine 2025 where things are going to be, right?
I mean, dual lens, three-dimensional photography, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that would be interesting. But is there a market for it? There are very few people. Don may do it. I may do it. Mm-hmm. But you know, will everybody do it? No. Should a product be made for it? They tried. There have been so many cameras made for 3D, and what happened? You know, one model comes out, it's done, it's over.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Don Komersko, what about you? I mean, what's missing from the current lineup, or what you know about what's coming that's public that you need that is not there, that you want Panasonic to build for you?
Okay, well, on Shiv's comment, if anybody listening to this is the owner of a Leica Stemar 3D lens from 1954 to 1957, I'm trying to find a copy of that lens that has no fog or fungus on it, which I can mount to a Panasonic S-Series camera and shoot some really fun 3D work, and no good full-frame, regular stereoscopic 3D camera has been made since the 1950s, and I need to get one of these things. So anybody out there listening, please contact me.
At any price, right?
Well, not any price. I mean, I'm going to be reasonable here, but I will pay what it's worth. The thing going on to that, though, is like in a general sense, I have never owned a camera that has had pixel shift resolution increasing technology. I shoot with the Lumix GX9, which does not have that feature. Frederick, you have that in the G9, and I would like that to be something to move forward with. The technology is there, and if I'm doing a still life subject, would I want more resolution when it's just built into the camera? Well, absolutely I would. I don't know what I would necessarily do with it, but to have it is always an asset, because I'm doing an art show. I'm actually preparing and planning for it right now in one of my local museums, and I'm going to be printing a bunch of 40 by 40 inch prints. Now, I would want them to be nosed right up to and not see any degradation in quality, but at 20 megapixels, I'm not going to get that, and that's what I'm shooting with right now. Mm-hmm. So the majority of images that I share, they're going to be online. They're going to be on Facebook or Flickr or elsewhere, and resolution does not matter at all there. But in the fringes, if you're trying to do some of those extreme things, resolution most certainly does. I like a rate of fire that is very fast. I like a dynamic range that is very good, but I mean, there's a lot of limiting factors on all of those. Dynamic range is only as good as you know how to get it out of the file, sure, because you still have to edit the image afterwards, mm-hmm, to your taste. And a rate of fire, if I'm shooting macro work, well, as fast as my camera, like I was shooting with the Canon 1DX Mark II for many years, and it can shoot at 14 frames per second. Never used it at that speed because my flash could never keep up with me, yeah, right? So, I mean, there's limitations all over the place that we're always trying to push into. And I just found, was it Bolt, one of the third-party manufacturers for flash accessories and things, has a battery pack that I can attach to my ring flash that instead of having 8 batteries, has 12. So now I can be firing whole hog with 16 batteries, including the 4 in the flash, to maybe eke that up a little bit. I don't know. I haven't tested it yet, but I sure as heck bought it because it could potentially increase my performance in that area. Will it make me a better photographer than I was last year? No, it won't, right, because the better photographer comes from the ideas that you have, not necessarily the equipment. But will it be a little bit more polished and have a little bit more flexibility in the terms of what you output down the road? Yeah, and I want that flexibility.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, what I'm hearing from both of you guys is it doesn't seem like that. It seems like camera bodies, and you could look at the lineup of across manufacturers of what cameras are looking like. And they look, for the most part, they look pretty similar, right? It's almost like cars. You can get in one car and then jump to a different brand and drive it successfully. But it sounds like the feature set on the bodies themselves and the overall features are great. And what I'm hearing from both of you is image quality, dynamic range, those sorts of things are where you'd like to see performances or improvements in. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Don said is, you know, important, because if all you're doing is showing your images online, or you're, you know, showing them at a resolution that doesn't really matter, any camera is good enough. But if you go into the print world, and if you're making really large prints, then yes, resolution starts playing a role into it. I mean, software algorithms exist that can allow you to build up and build pixels to make large. But, you know, in reality, you want it native. You want it native, the native pixel to be sized enough to do that.
Right.
And getting back to the gear aspect of it, just imagine, okay, if Panasonic was able to do what they were able to do with the G9, to actually do pixel shifting, and to be able to produce in camera an image that you can now process in Lightroom or whatever, whereas with the Sony system, you need other software and it doesn't work too well. Think about it with a 47 megapixel full frame sensor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, it's got image stabilization, which means it can shift. And if it can shift, if they do pixel shift in that camera, what kind of image will you get? Just think about that.
Yeah.
I mean, this could be huge.
Yeah.
I mean, if just basically 45 times 4, that might be the resolution.
Yeah, and it's like I said, it's 2018, right? So there's a lot of room for improvement in all this stuff. So let's start wrapping things up. I want to talk a little bit about the industry and bring it full circle. And like I said, there's you know, I could read down the list, right, of the different camera manufacturers out there. Do you guys think that is it time for a coalescing? And sort of an evolution of the industry where some brands get absorbed into other brands and some brands go away completely, and you know, and we end up with, you know, just a few strong players in there. Don Komarczyk, what do you think? Is it time for the quickening, of the photography space?
That's a really hard question to answer. I mean, every camera manufacturer is making good cameras. I don't think anybody would question that. Unless you bought the Yashica Y35, you probably bought a good camera. And so when we look at the industry as a whole, it all happens to be how many photographers are out there that are buying them. A lot of people might be transitioning towards a cell phone. You know, the new iPhones are exceptional right out of the gate to get a very passable photo for a lot of people. And so there's a certain part of the market share that is going in that direction because they don't care about all of the bells and whistles and the spec sheets that we all drool over here as photographers listening to this podcast. Mm-hmm. But of those that are here, is that number growing or shrinking? And I'd like to think that it is staying about stable. And there's different markets for it, as we established. For Micro Four Thirds, it's a different market than a full frame and a medium format camera, et cetera. And there's film that's, you know, still coming back. I mean, Kodak has just reintroduced the Ektar 100 film. And yes, I bought a couple of rolls of that. Or not Ektar, Ektachrome, sorry. And I hope I'll be able to shoot it before it expires. When does it expire? Sometime in 2020. That's hit or miss.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going
to camera long enough. Oh, yeah,
keep that in the refrigerator, man.
Yeah, but you look at where the industry is going and how these different segments are being associated. I think that there is enough room for all of the current players to stay in the game. And I think that's a really valuable thing, because the more competition you have as a consumer, the better it is for you.
Yeah.
Because all of these people are going to try to put out and put that little bit of extra research and development into making their product better than the competition. The less competition you have, the less effort people put into beating the competition. And so the more players, the better for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Shiv Verma, what about you? You think it's time for the purge, or the more the merrier?
Well, I don't think it's time for the purge yet. I think we need to have this competition. It needs to be, competition does a bunch of things. It forces people to innovate. And that is what we're always looking for. And as long as innovation continues, competition is a good thing. When it stops, then who cares? Then you've just got, you know, a product and you've done it. 35 millimeter film cameras became that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why you got to a point where you bought one and you kept it for 10 years.
Yeah.
Which camera do you keep for 10 years? I mean, whether it's, and it isn't even the gas part of it. It's just the fact that these cameras will go obsolete. And you would do what you wanted to do. And there are things that, you know, even though I didn't answer the question in its entirety before, there are things that we're looking for. I mean, Don brings up a good point. I'd like a camera to be able to fire its flash at the same rate as the sensor can be fired. So, I mean, that's something. I mean, how about 60 frames a second? So fire my flash at the same rate. Technology could potentially do that at some point, but then, you know, somebody will come around and say, well, put a static, you know, always on light and do it.
Yeah, right.
But it doesn't have the power. So, you know, it's stuff like that. I mean, we're going to continue to innovate for a considerable number of years. And as long as that's in play, competition's good. Keep it there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, maybe somebody dies, but who cares? Nikon might die. Canon might die.
Yeah. Well, that's evolution, right? So
yeah. We need it.
Yeah, that's good. That's thinning the herd so that the strongest can survive. I think that's awesome. And I think, you know, as consumers, you know, you bring up a good point, Shiv. As we look at this stuff, it used to be back in the day that it was, you're right, you know, every couple of years or so, we would upgrade our cameras or whatever. But most of the important hardware, all the hardware I have, I guess, is important. But most of my most used hardware, i.e. my computer, my cameras, my phone, my tablet, those things feel like they're on a subscription plan. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It feels like they're on a subscription planned obsolescence upgrade path. And I know within 18 months to 2 years, I'm going to get rid of it. And it's going to be passed either into the family or it's going to go somewhere else. And, you know, we'll have a new piece of gear there. So,
well, but there's another thing that hasn't happened in the camera industry, which might happen. So they come up with a firmware type of upgrade, which basically enhances performance capabilities, whatever. Mm-hmm. And just like Apple did, if your product is 3 years old, I'm sorry, this is not going to work on it.
Yeah, right.
So now you're going to be forced into, you know, using the newer product line because the older product line just can't do it.
Yeah.
What's worse is that now try selling that thing.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to buy it.
No one's going to buy it, yeah. And I'll tell you, I'll answer my own question because I asked the question before about what's missing from cameras or from Lumix or whatever that you'd want to have added in. So my request would be to have an app ecosystem and always on cellular technology built into my camera, kind of like my phone and my tablet, right? So I want to be able to say, you know what, kind of like Sony did this with, they tried it.
Well, Panasonic did that.
It was an Android based or something. I want something stronger and I wanted Panasonic, you know.
Are you saying Android is not strong?
I'm saying I prefer my iOS devices. That's what
all right.
You know, I don't own Android, like, so I don't know.
Always on iOS driven camera.
Right, but wouldn't it be cool to be able to say, to look on the back of your screen, because we all have screens, and say, you know, go in and say, hey, I want to do this intervalometer. I need an intervalometer that can do X, Y, and Z. Download it from a robust app ecosystem that is hosted by Panasonic and vetted by Panasonic, download it and run with it. Wouldn't that be cool?
You could have everything that we want as photographers is what's coming out because we already have everything that we need. The wants are what drives the entire industry.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's all. And many things in life, I guess, is that.
Everything connected is through one place, and it's shivverma.com, www.shivverma.com. Just go there and have fun.
Awesome. And Shiv, thank you for coming on, man. I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. Don Komarechka, man, what about you? If people want to get into the world of Doncom, where do they go?
Well, much the same way, everything is linked to from one primary source, doncom.ca, doncom.ca. Got a bunch of macro photography workshops coming up in 2019 and an Iceland tour about a year from now in October 2019 that will be a lot of fun. You can find all of that at that website. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, photogeekweekly.com. It would be great to have anybody listening to this check that out as well.
This is Twitter.